thank you very much for the introduction. And communication is an issue, especially I know with my I was having a discussion with my wife just last week. I said to her, Javi, every male deserves one caveman day a month, in which we don't have to be sensitive or discuss the kids or anything like that. Just want to come downstairs and say, man want egg. And she said, yeah, it's a great idea, but you've already had 28 of those days this month, so you're over your quota. So in any case, what I'd like to talk about today is actually the communication of Torah, which is, I usually call this class, The Rabbi Made Me Do It, which basically addresses, I want to address three basic questions. And before I get there, I was in Fort Worth, Texas, a number of years ago. I was talking about Judaism, which is what I usually do, unless they pay me enough to talk about other religions. Anyway, so I was talking about Judaism, and a guy kept asking questions about the Bible. And he said, Rabbi, the Bible says this, the Bible says that. And he kept asking me questions about the Bible. So I said to him, look, I am an Orthodox rabbi. It's not really that relevant to ask me questions about the Bible because I don't believe in the Bible. I said, in fact, Orthodox Jews simply don't believe in the Bible, so it's not really that relevant to actually talk to me about that. So he was a little, shocked by that. He was a little upset. Actually, he was very upset. When I got out of hospital, I explained to him that... I said to him the following. I said, look, when you actually talk about the Bible, what you mean is a literalist, fundamentalist translation of the five books of Moses. I said, that is not Judaism, my friend. I said, Judaism is Torah, and the Torah includes much, much more than the Bible. In fact, we know the vast majority of Jewish practice, the vast bulk of what we do on an everyday basis, the vast bulk of what we understand about Torah actually comes from what we call Torah Shebal Peh, the oral tradition. In fact, what you see of the Torah in the text of the Bible is really only the tip of the iceberg of Judaism. And the vast bulk of it lies beneath the surface. So that is what I'd like to explain today, is the idea of the Torah Shebal Peh, and three questions regarding that. Question number one, why do we need it? In other words, why indeed can't we just open up the Tanakh, read what it says, and do it, and end of story? Why do the rabbis actually seem to have to complicate things with the oral law? In other words, why do we need it? How do we know it exists? That's question number one. Question number two is, what's the advantage of having any type of oral law? Wouldn't it be better to write everything down? I mean, if you've ever done any contracts, written any contract, if it's not written down, it's as good as non-existent. So you're going to have a problem if you don't write it down. And the question is, why didn't Hashem just write everything down, make it simpler? And the third question is, how do we know it was transmitted accurately? Perhaps there was distortion, deliberate or accidental, somewhere along the 1,500 years in which it was transmitted verbally, which is, I think, a legitimate question. So those are the three questions I'd like to address. Now, let me start with the idea that Hebrew, as you know, is almost the exact opposite of Hawaiian. That, I probably don't need to explain that, so let me go on to the next point. I will explain, okay, because I see there's some puzzled faces. See, Hawaiian is almost all vowels, like that type of thing. Whereas Hebrew is almost, obviously different pronunciations of things, but in Hebrew, it's very heavily consonants. And indeed, the vowels are actually not there in the Torah. The dots and the dashes, the nekudot, that give us the actual correct pronunciation of the Hebrew language are not existent in the Torah. So, for example, you have words like this. So, how would you read the first word? You might read the first word. There's a few different ways of reading that first word. How would you read it? Yirah, which means fear. Yireh, which means he will see. Yireh, which means he will be seen. Now, there's a few different, those are totally different meanings. Yirah means fear. Yireh, he will see. Yireh, he will be seen. When the Torah says three times a year, all men, Yud Resh Aleph Hey, in the temple, in front of God, what does that mean? Three times a year, all men shall fear God? My wife says, halavai, that would be wonderful. Right? Does it mean three times a year all men shall see God? That means we'll have prophecy three times a year. Or does it mean, as indeed we pronounce it, yeira'eh, three times a year you have to go to the Beit HaMikdash to be seen in the presence of God? Or for example, the Torah says, don't eat any chalev. Correct. So you know the correct pronunciation. But if you didn't know that pronunciation, you might think it says, don't eat any chalav, milk. Or a few sentences later when it says, don't cook a kid in its mother's... Well, you might read a chalev, don't cook a kid in its mother's fat, which would be prohibit deep frying in Jewish tradition, which would be a serious issue for yeshiva diets, right? And so we know that one of them is read chalev, which was a certain type of fat. The other one is read chalev, which is actually the milk. Or, for instance, the last one, when it says, erase the zecher Amalek. What does that mean? The memory. So someone once, very famous, read it as Zachar, erase the males of Amalek, which is a big difference between memory and males, Zachar and Zecher. Right, so in order to actually read the text of the Torah, and in fact to pronounce it, you have to have an oral tradition. Because where do we know the pronunciation from? The answer is we hear the Torah being read, someone heard it being read, from someone who heard it being read, from someone who heard it being read, with the correct pronunciation by the giver. And so therefore, part of what the oral tradition supplies is just simply how to read the Torah. Now, in addition to that, if you look at the text of the Torah, there's no punctuation whatsoever. Recently bought my wife a book. It's about punctuation. It is called, you've seen this? Eat Shoots and Leaves. It's the importance of correct punctuation. So obviously, either if you put a comma after eats, shoots, and leaves, what you're saying is panda bears from China, are vicious creatures. They eat, they shoot, bam, right, and then they leave. Okay, if you leave out the comma, then all it's saying is that the diet of a panda includes shoots and leaves. Okay, so very big difference. The comma is either slandering the panda population and accusing them of violence brought on by eating, right? Or it is basically saying something about what pandas eat, which is basically a vegetarian diet. So punctuation is important. Just for example, there was a very famous telegram which was sent by Trotsky. You've heard of Trotsky. Trotsky was a great enemy of Stalin. We know this because Stalin actually had him assassinated. Although some say this is not evidence. Stalin used to do that just for the heck of it. But in any case, it is believed by all historians. Stalin and Trotsky were total terrible enemies. So Trotsky sends the following telegram to Stalin. Dear Stalin, I was wrong. You were right. I should apologize, Trotsky. You were wrong, I was right, I should apologize, Trotsky. So Stalin reads this out at a meeting of the Communist Party Congress. He says, you see, my greatest enemy has agreed that I am right. And everyone claps, of course, because they don't want to die. And so what happens is that a Jew in the audience says, Comrade Stalin, may I please read the telegram with greater emotion? And he says, certainly. And the Jew comes up to stage, and he takes the telegram and he reads it in the following way. Dear Stalin, you were wrong. I was right. I should apologize, Trotsky. Which is a tad different from the original, depending on your emotion. I remember going swimming in Ain Gedi with my kids. Security guard came over, and he says, can't you read the sign that says, no swimming allowed? I said, that's how you read it? I read it differently. No, swimming allowed. I understand from my own sons that this is how most teenagers read signs. But in any case, someone asked if I lecture the teenagers. I said all the time. Anyway, so in order to read the Torah with correct emphasis, correct emotion, correct punctuation, where do you get this from? The answer is the Torah, when you hear it read in shul, is not actually read, unless the Bal Korah is really lousy, it is actually sung or chanted. There are notes, which even though different communities have different ways of singing them, but nevertheless there are certain rules in common amongst the various notes, which indicate pause, indicate emphasis, which indicate hesitation, which indicate enthusiasm, end of sentence, end of phrase, continuity, etc. That punctuation, so to speak, that emotion, which is derived from the laning, from the Tamei HaMikra, from the way in which we read the Torah, that's also part of the oral tradition that conveys to us these ideas. Finally, there is also legal definitions. The Torah ultimately is a legal text. Yet, it's a legal text that leaves out everything you need in order to actually put it into practice. The Torah tells us, on the 10th day of the 7th month, you shall afflict your soul. Anyone know what that is?
Yom Kippur.
Yom Kippur, correct. Right, but if you didn't have the Torah Shebal Peh, all the Torah says is on the 10th day of the 7th month, afflict your soul. What does afflicting your soul mean? Roll around on thumbtacks? Read Russian novels? Do both simultaneously? Synagogues in California that do this. In any case, the point I'm making is that really the Torah is a closed book. I mean, things very, very simple. There are very simple things that apparently are simple, which require vast amounts of definition, which the Torah leaves out. Don't murder requires a definition of humans. I know, I mean, to us it's probably obvious, but there are many people who it's not obvious to, right? What does murder include? Peter Singer, famous, he's actually, I think, head of bioethics department in Princeton University, who believes that there's basically no difference, and there should be no difference ethically, morally, and in terms of rights between humans and the great apes. He's actually one of the leaders of what's called the Great Ape Project. Which is, it's not, he's not like building a thing in his basement, a la Far Side type stuff, you know. But rather, he is trying to advocate for equal rights for the great apes with humans, with or what he calls other primates. Right? I know that in New Zealand, a couple of years ago, they actually brought a law into the parliament, actually voted into law, equal rights for the great apes. To my knowledge, no great apes are native to New Zealand, aside perhaps from members of parliament. But nevertheless... Nevertheless, what you have to do first of all is define a human. To whom does murder apply? You have to then define self-defense. You have to define things like what's murder. I mean, is it killing an innocent human being who's not threatening you or anyone else deliberately? There's many. When does human life start? When does it end? All these are issues in the definition of lo tirtzach. Don't murder. And it becomes quite complex. So the Torah, however, does allude to a body of information other than that which is written. The Torah, for instance, in Devarim 12, the Torah says the following, you shall slaughter, v'zavachta, shall slaughter, of your cattle and your flocks that Hashem has given you, as I have commanded, ka'asher tziviticha, as I have commanded you. Interestingly enough, nowhere in the 24 books of Tanakh does it say exactly how to slaughter an animal. It says what not to eat, it says which animals to eat, it says what parts of the animal not to eat, it tells us what to not to eat it with, is that, but it never says how to slaughter an animal. And yet the Torah tells us, ka'asher tziviticha, as I have commanded you. Where, the Talmud says, did God command us regarding how to slaughter an animal? The answer is, in the Torah Shebal Peh. And in fact, the way Rav Hirsch understands it is that the Torah Shebal Peh and the written law and the oral law are related like lecture notes and a lecture. When did the Jews hear the lecture of the oral law? The oral law is the lecture. The notes is the Torah Shebichtav, the five books of Moses. When did the Jews hear the oral law? The answer is, how long were we in the desert? 40 years, right? When did all the major events happen? Which years did the major events of the desert happen? First and the last, the first two and the last, right? So, okay, in the middle, there's approximately 37 years. The Jews have all their food provided for, climate controlled, and they're in the desert. What are they doing? They didn't have Xbox or Game Boys, right? They didn't have MP3 players. They basically had a nice, clear desert night. What were they doing for 38 years? Oh, it's a nice night again. You know what I mean? The stars are out. Yeah, duh, right? And this is it. 38 years, for heaven's sakes. It's amazing there were not more rebellions during that time. I'm just out of boredom, for heaven's sakes. Let's have a good plague. You know, there's nothing else to do. So... I mean, I'm paraphrasing the Or HaChaim very loosely. I hope he forgives me. Anyway, but you see, the answer, what the Jews were doing in the desert for that time, the Or HaChaim and other commentaries say, they were actually absorbing the Torah Shebal Peh. They were absorbing the oral law. That is when we were getting the lecture. That's when we were getting all the information. So once you heard the information in the lecture, and you had the notes would be clear. But if you never heard the lecture, and you didn't understand how the shorthand works in the notes, you wouldn't have a clue what is being talked about. Everyone here, I would guess, is privy to parts of the lecture. If I tell you something in code, a shorthand version of it, you'll probably know what I'm talking about. But someone who never heard of it wouldn't have a clue. For example, if I tell you here, I'd like you all to bind a sign upon your arm and stick a frontlet between your eyes. Now, if you didn't hear of tefillin, you would probably, what would you do? Go to a piercing parlor? I'd like a frontlet between my eyes, please. Right? Sure, put your head in the clamp, get the 16th of an inch drill bit, and let's do it. Right? But you see, the fact is that you are part of what's called the Torah Shebaal Peh Club, the Oral Law Club, which is that we already know. When you ask most Jews, what does it mean to afflict your soul on the 10th day of the 7th month, most Jews will say it means to fast and to listen to the chazan. To fast, right? Which is the affliction of the soul that is meant in the Torah itself. And that is because we have heard the lecture and we know the shorthand. And for example, the same is true in virtually any subject where you have a certain shorthand. Imagine you are studying chemistry. You go to college, you study chemistry. And not that I wish it upon anyone, but let's say, right? Okay. In any case, I'm sorry. A lecture is incomplete if I didn't offend a member of the faculty. So anyway, so now it works like this. There you are in college, and you've just gone to a fascinating chemistry lecture. And there you are, sitting there in the cafeteria, kosher, and you are reading your notes on this lecture. An English literature major comes over to you, a friend of yours, acquaintance, okay, and says, you look fascinated by that lecture. I said, oh, it was the best lecture of the year. I'm trying to just review it. It's unbelievable. And the English lit major says, can I see the notes? And I say, sure. And he looks at the notes and he does this. You've been drinking this stuff? This makes no sense. This makes no sense. This is gobbledygook. What is this person's problem? Aside from being an English lit major, what is the other problem? Right. Anyone else I offended? I'm sorry. Okay, good. Right. So, what else? What is the problem? I'll tell you the problem. This person did not hear the lecture and doesn't know the shorthand. For example, in chemistry, there's a shorthand. No one will write, for example, sodium chloride, sodium chloride. What will you write? NaCl. You'll write NaCl, N-A-C-L. Okay? Yes, I put some NaCl on the... Can I pass the NaCl, please? Right? So, or for example, you will not write uranium, you'll write whatever that is. Right? Or for example... I didn't do well in chemistry. Right? What's that? Right, that's water. Now, for example, if you're writing, you know, this is also shorthand. Down there are, you know, these are not just punctuation down there. That's actually a secret shorthand used by only about 100 million people throughout the world, right, in emails and stuff like that. Smiley face. I mean, people who use it enough, you know, they say, hi, hey, you know, how are you doing today? Oh, fine. Right, that type of thing, right? I mean, so you can really tell if someone's a nerd, right, because they're always doing it, like, on the side. I'm really weird. Anyway, so what I am pointing out here, folks, is, and this is as Rav Samson Raphael Hirsch points this out, that the five books of Moses, the Chumash really is written in shorthand. It's written in shorthand. If you heard the entire lecture, Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral law, and you then look at the shorthand, you understand what it's saying. But if you never heard the lecture and you don't know the shorthand, you will be clueless. And so that is the answer to our first question. Why do we need the oral law? How do we know it exists? Basically, from the Torah itself, because either the author was cruel and sadistic and gave us this book that says, listen, don't eat this or else you will die. And we say, excuse me, yes, could you please explain how we figure out what it is not to eat? Sorry. Just experiment, you'll see, right? I mean, it'd be like the United States, you know, the United States gives a nuclear reactor to some third world country and says, folks, we have in our generosity decided to give you a nuclear reactor to provide electric power for pretty much for years to come. And they say, oh, wow, thank you, that's great. And says, can we have the instruction book, by the way? No, I'm sorry, just experiment with it, you know. Heavy water, you know, tonic water, martini, whatever, you know, see how it works, right? And if, you know, see how it works out. Obviously, that would be cruel, sadistic. God did not do that. He gave us the instruction book, Oral Law, and he also gave us shorthand notes of it, Chumash, five books of Moses. And that is our first question. The second question we asked was, what's the advantage? Why not write everything down? Why have a system? I understand if I'm sitting at a lecture and I have to write notes, it's not worth it. I don't write down every single word. I write shorthand. I write it in, I use code, I write every second, whatever it is. So I understand that, because I have a limitation of time. But obviously God is not limited in terms of time. There's no reason he could not write down the whole thing. What is the advantage of not writing it down? So I think there's a few points here. First of all, communication is not merely in giving over facts. Very often communication is most effective when it's person to person. Just to give you an example, almost every area of knowledge, there is an oral law, an oral tradition. Just for example, I asked physicians very often this question: where did you learn more about the care and diagnosis of of patients? When you were first 4 years of medical school or when you worked in the hospital? Most physicians have told me when I worked in the hospital. And I asked people, lawyers, where did you learn more about the practice of law? 4 years of law school or when you actually worked in a law office? Most said in the law office. The difference is they were getting what's called, maybe called, the oral tradition of the physician or of the lawyer, etc., as they are learning it. And that is true of many fields. The difference, for instance, between Texas A&M and Harvard, right, is $30,000. But aside from that, it's also the textbooks that they get are the same textbooks. Anyone can get onto Amazon or addall.com and you can get any book just about that exists in the world. There's no reason that any university cannot get exactly the same textbooks as some top university. The difference is who is communicating the material, with whom you are discussing it, with whom you are interacting. These are all what I would think is part of the oral tradition or part of the oral Torah, so to speak, of every area of knowledge. I'll give you another example. Torah is not just teaching facts, teaching a lifestyle and activities. Anyone who knows how to swim, please put up your hand. Excellent, excellent. Most people know how to swim. Put your hands down. This is very good. I'm very happy. Right. Anyone who learned how to swim from a book, please put up your hand. Really? So now, it works like this. I've asked this question literally all over the world of thousands of people. I've asked this simple question. Thousands of people all over the world, literally, for the past 20 years, I've been asking the question, who learned how to swim from a book? Never do they put their hands up. You know why? I'll tell you why. Because, tragically, people who learn how to swim from a book are not with us anymore. And therefore, they're not here to put up their hands. Because you see, there are certain skills, you know, like you read the book, oh yeah, with the book, you know, it's like, oh yeah, I've seen a video, it's no problem, I can do it, right? Then you jump into the pool and goodbye, right? So the point is, there are lots of life skills that require actual oral tradition in order to learn them. Things which are simple. There's a little exercise a friend of mine did once, which is he got people in a classroom. Everyone had to write written instructions, step-by-step written instructions on how to tie your shoelace, and then exchange them with each other, and then tie their shoelaces based purely on the written instructions that each person wrote. He says it was horrific. There were two near suffocations. There was a guy suspended from the roof. It was unbelievable, right? But you see, I don't know, I'm exaggerating slightly, but what you do need is there are certain areas of life where you actually do need oral law. That's number one. Number two, the way it is designed is the Torah itself is portable and compact, and all the rest of it can be derived from the text using the rules of the oral tradition, which is important because the Jewish people have been expelled from many countries. We've had our books stolen and burnt, and as long as we have the Chumash intact and we have the oral law and the rules of the oral law in our minds, we can actually virtually derive everything from the text using the rules and the logic and the grammatical rules, etc., of the oral tradition. So it's almost like I would look at the Chumash as a compressed file. If you're sending a file, which is a massive file, you should zip it or compress it. And, of course, a compressed file is impossible to read, but what happens is you feed it into a unzip program, which then will expand the file. I would look at it as the oral law is type of like the decompression program, and the written law is type of like the zipped file. Next, although this sounds counterintuitive, but I think it's true, it is harder to steal the oral law than it is the written law. For example, the written law, the Chumash, much of it has been taken away from us. By taken away, what I mean is, has been taken and claimed as its own by many other people. It has been misquoted and distorted and taken out of context. You ask anyone today, just walk along the street and ask people, Who said, love your neighbour as yourself? Guarantee, the vast majority of people will say, Jesus. The truth of the matter is, it was actually said, as you know, in Vayikra, Leviticus 19, in our Torah, thousands of years beforehand. And actually, in the New Testament, it's misquoted. Right? So it actually says, you've heard it said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I tell you, resist not evil. It doesn't actually say, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. The Torah actually says, love your neighbor as yourself, I am God. That's the end of the verse. So, to a great degree, much of the Chumash has been taken away and misused and misquoted and put into the wrong context, etc. That did not happen to the oral law. Why didn't that happen to the oral law? Because the oral law existed in our minds, in our practices. If I think something, no one can take it away, no one can distort it, no one can misquote it. When I say something, then it's open to being misquoted and distorted. When I write it down, you can say goodbye. Once you write it down, it is in the public field. Anyone can take it and pretty much do what they want with it. And that has happened to a great degree to much of the Chumash. Did not happen to the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral law. In addition, when you have an oral law, what it means is, in order for it to survive, what has to happen? That has to be a nationwide program of what? Of study. It cannot survive. If you have everything written down, all you need is a humidity-controlled library in order to preserve it. If it's not written down, what you need to do is, everyone has to study. Everyone has to teach. Everyone has to review. Everyone's going to be part of this great learning program, which I think is a fantastic thing, because it created within the Jewish people this tremendous, tremendous study ethic, a tremendous love for learning, a tremendous love for study, which has actually come out in many different ways. Whether it's the often quoted percentage of Nobel Prizes we get, whether it is the incredible contribution we've made to every area of knowledge, of literature, of science, of medicine, in every single area, Jews have made an enormous contribution. This is nothing genetic. It's because within the Jewish people, there's been a tremendous study ethic. The story was told, actually, by Gershom Scholem about a non-Jewish friend of his who went to... He was in Warsaw just before the Second World War, looking for a taxi. Taxis then were horse-drawn carriages. And he can't find a taxi, but he sees a whole row of horse-drawn carriages lined up in the Jewish area, no drivers in sight, just a couple of kids watching the carriages. So he walks over to a kid and he says, where are the drivers? I need a taxi. Kid says, come, I'll show you. Takes him into a small shul, small synagogue in Warsaw, and there the Jewish taxi drivers are sitting around studying Mishnah together. They all took a break at the same time so they could study Mishnah, study Jewish law together. And this man was amazed. He has heard of taxi drivers praying. He's heard of their passengers praying devoutly, right? But he never actually has seen an idea that the taxi drivers will take off time and actually study. I mean, let's transfer this to New York City. Can you imagine the following scenario? There you are in New York City. You need a taxi. There's a whole bunch of yellow cabs lined up, parked outside the New York Public Library. Not a taxi driver in sight. There's a couple of kids, gang members, who are watching the taxis. So you look around, you ask the kid, excuse me, but where are the taxi drivers? He says, come, I'll show you. He takes you into a room in the New York Public Library, and there all the New York taxi drivers are sitting around studying the Constitution of the United States. How likely is this scenario? Right, first of all, they should study English. I think that would be a great thing. Driving would be a close second, and I think personal hygiene would be a close third. But you see, the idea that they would study, the idea that they'd be sitting around studying the Constitution is just ludicrous. Yet, throughout the generation, and it's still true today, Jews from all walks of life will sit down and study together in their spare time. People will go in their spare time, they'll go to a class in Nach, they'll go to a class in Daf Yomi. It is absolutely incredible to see a nation that is involved in voluntary study in their spare time, in their recreational time, and I think this can be directly attributed to the oral tradition and the fact that it was oral. E is personal contact. You see, we believe it's important to have a contact with the previous generation because we believe we can learn a lot of things. Aside from facts, we can learn a way of life and an attitude from the previous generation. If everything's written down, I don't need to go to a human from the previous generation. I can merely get it from a book. But when things are not all written down, I need, and even though they're written down today, they're still in the Mishnah and the Talmud very cryptic. You still need to have a Rebbe, you still need to have a teacher. And so consequently, what you're going to do is you are going to have contact with the previous generation so you can actually learn ethics, morals, how to act, how to behave. That's not always true in most disciplines. Many disciplines, the person teaching doesn't necessarily believe in what they're teaching and they don't necessarily live it. Famous case was Bertrand Russell. Bertrand Russell was teaching at a city University of New York for a short time. He's a British philosopher, very famous British philosopher. He wrote one of his most famous books, History of Western Philosophy. Bertrand Russell was teaching a course in ethics of relationships. Human intimacy, love, sexuality, relationships. He was teaching a course in ethics in those areas. And it was rumored at the time that he was actually had relationships with two of his students. Now, this is a little bit of a problem when you're teaching a course, like, even if you're not teaching a course like that. So a student confronted him, and a very famous, and said, "Lord Russell, how can you teach a course in ethics and actually have relationships with your students?" And he said, "My dear fellow, is the geometry professor a triangle?" In other words, he felt you could teach geometry without being a geometric figure, right? In the same way, you could teach ethics without being ethical. He did not feel a contradiction, right? And indeed, for him, it was not a contradiction. He knew more about the field, he'd written more about the field, he'd researched it more than anyone else in the university, so basically, he's qualified to teach it. The fact that he doesn't believe it, the fact that he's a lowlife, the fact that he didn't follow anything or he teaches, irrelevant. But you see, in Judaism, he's supposed to learn how to live, and that you have to go to a human being. F is anti-superficiality. I think the Torah Shebaal Peh teaches us not to be superficial. The way the Torah is designed, as soon as you look at the text, immediately what you're meant to do is look for questions. You're meant to ask yourself questions, you're meant to be critical, you're meant to analyze it, because it teaches us that the truth cannot be found without great effort. And the true pshat, true explanation of the verses in the Torah can only be found with effort. The same is true in any area of life. You will not understand the truth about a person unless you put effort into them. You'll not understand the truth about nature unless you put effort into it. You won't understand the truth of history unless you put effort into it. And we learn that from the fact that the Torah is written in such a way that it's totally a closed book, makes no sense unless you put effort into it. That is taught by a division of written law and oral law. Finally, there is the Tai Chi principle of Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral law. People familiar with Tai Chi?
No.
Tai Chi is a Chinese martial art. It's a Chinese martial art. Probably there may be people here who study it, I don't know. It's a Chinese martial art which is actually done by a lot of people as a form of exercise very, very slowly, right? Obviously, it's not effective as a martial art to hit someone like this, right? You'd have to do it faster, most likely, right? But as it's a martial art. Now, there was a great Tai Chi master who was explaining to one of his students the idea behind what's called a Tai Chi turn. Now, a Tai Chi turn... Volunteer? No, it's okay. Right, a Tai Chi turn is basically this. It's just a very simple, relaxing exercise in which you turn, you swing, your feet stay planted, and you turn like that. So he's explaining to the student the idea of a Tai Chi turn. He says, when you understand Tai Chi turn, then you can leave monastery. But anyway, before he actually told him that you have to be old to understand that one. But anyway, so as he turns, he says, the idea of the Tai Chi turn is to change enough to stay the same. Change enough to stay the same. What did he mean? He explained in the following way. He said, someone pushes you in the shoulder. Most people's reaction is to push back with their shoulder, in which case you're now off balance, right? And if the other person's stronger than you, you'll probably fall over or at least stumble backwards. So the teacher was saying, the sensei was saying, that if you have a Tai Chi turn, what it means is someone pushes you in the shoulder, you turn. And therefore, you go with the blow, in which case you've changed enough to stay the same. So the person who's off balance when they've pushed you is the pusher, not the pushy, right? So as you do the turn, of course, he said to combine it with the hand behind the neck and the knee in the face, right? But basically, right, that's not part of the oral tradition idea. But I think the oral tradition idea, please do not try this at home. Anyway, unless your sister's really annoying you. But anyway, the principle of the Tai Chi turn, which is to change enough to stay the same is based on the idea. This is the Torah Shebaal Peh has the same concept. Much of it is given in such a way that it will be interpreted by the sages, the Sanhedrin, the Jewish Supreme Court, and they will be able to apply it to every time, every place, every situation. And in fact, I'll give you an example of a major Tai Chi turn that was done in the Talmud. The Talmud says the ideal method of education, according to the Torah, is parent to child. V'shinamtam levanecha. There are no schools in biblical tradition. However, Yeshua ben Gamla saw, the Gemara says, Bava Batra, the Gemara says, Yeshua ben Gamla saw that there were many orphans, there was a lot of poverty, there was a lot of displacement, there had been warfare all because of the Romans, and what happened was the system was breaking down. There were a lot of children who were not receiving Torah. So he instituted a system of schools. And he made a whole system of rules regarding these schools. What's interesting is this was a massive and revolutionary change, but it was a change of the Tai Chi type, meaning it was to change enough to stay the same. So he did this revolution, but we stayed the same. Those are some of the advantages of the oral law. Now, what are some of the disadvantages? Well, the main disadvantage, this is our third question now. We've answered the second question, what are the advantages? We're now up to question number three, which is the disadvantage. The disadvantage is, in Australia we used to play a game in school called Broken Telephone. Anyone ever play Broken Telephone? That's not vandalizing the public phone. That's maybe in America, I don't know. But in any case, right, we used to play this game called Broken Telephone, which was the following. Right, a teacher would whisper some message to the first child in the group. He would then transmit it to the next person in the group, and so on and so forth. And by the end of the group, let's say after 10 kids, they would then write down the message on the board. The message would almost certainly be the wrong message. So the common question is, the oral law has been transmitted in that fashion from 1313 BCE, when the Torah was given, till about 200 CE, when Yehuda Hanasi, Judah the Prince, wrote the Mishnah down. That's approximately 1,500 years of people saying, pass it on. Right? So inevitably, there's got to be distortion here. How could it be that there's none? So that's the basic question. Clear? Okay. So in order to understand this, I'll say first few things. First of all, in information theory, it works like this. If you have information and you pass it down one channel, then you've got a certain probability that it will go wrong. Let's say you pass the same information through 10 channels. Have you increased or decreased the probability of knowing the original message from the messages that were passed down? You've increased the probability. You know why? Because even if each channel has a distortion, it's not necessarily going to be the same distortion. So for example, let's say in our classroom we have 100 students, and we have divide them into 10 groups of 10, and the teacher gives the following message, A, B, C, D. So you heard me say it? What did I say?
A, B, C, D.
Correct. A, B, C, D. Now, if I whisper that, and each group of 10 passes it down the line, there may be distortion. Some kid, right, all he's ever heard from a teacher is ADHD. So he passes down...
ADHD, right.
No, that's all he's ever heard from any adult are those letters in sequence, okay? Then you've got some other kid, right? Maybe another kid in one of the other groups. His parents are major league old time rock and roll fans. Nebuch, the poor kid, right? And all he hears is AC/DC, right? And he passes down AC/DC. And then, so you may have another kid who's not familiar with the poetry, the beauty, and the depth of the Australian accent, and he may have thought that I said IBCD instead of ABCD, which are totally different letters, obviously, right? And so he will say IBCD. Now, what will happen here is you will have a chart at the end. It will have 10 columns. Right? Each group will have a row. And what you'll see is in the first column, 9 out of 10 said A. One of the groups said I. In the second column, 7 out of 10 said B. In the third column, 8 out of 10 said C. And so on and so forth. You will be able to figure out, just by probability, that the original message was indeed A, B, C, D. In fact, how many chains of transmission have there been in Judaism since the time of Sinai? The answer is, every single mother and daughter, every grandfather and grandson, every father and son has been another link. Every family is a link in that chain. And the fact is there are plenty of people today who are keeping Shabbat and Kashrut and various laws of Judaism that actually did not study them in a book. They learnt them from their parents, and their parents from their parents, all the way back to Mount Sinai. It's quite an extraordinary phenomenon, and it's pretty amazing to see this type of idea. And indeed, every single Jew has been another one of those 10 those groups that we designated. So if I want to send a message to someone, I will leave a message on their cell phone, on their home phone, on their office phone. I will send them a fax and an email and a text message. I will send them a telegram and a registered letter and a singing telegram and a gorillagram. And basically, even though the gorilla may get mugged, and even though the fax machine is out of paper and their quota is full on the email and their cell phone is out of service, but they'll eventually get the message somehow. They'll hate me at the end of this, right? I have a lot of people hate me out there, right? But eventually they will get the message. And the same is true of the Torah Shabbal pair. That is answer number one in terms of security mechanisms. Number two, the message, the comparison to broken telephone is not fair. In broken telephone, the message is something which is a complete surprise, which you first hear about when you're in third or fourth or fifth grade. However, when does one start actually learning about Torah Shabbal pair, about Torah? In the regular normal, traditional family, you start learning about Torah when? As soon as you open your eyes. As when you're an infant, right? A little baby will see Shabbos candles and they'll hear the family say things like Shabbos or Shabbat Shalom or whatever it is. They will have a little bit of wine put in their mouth, right? Kiddush. They'll remember that well, especially if it's wine, right? And especially if they're a baby, etc. But what happens is you pick up information. It is ingrained in you. It is much harder to forget something that's ingrained in you from the time you're in cannabulum, in the cradle, as opposed to something which comes as a complete surprise. I mean, obviously, when my son becomes bar mitzvah, right? He's not going to look at the tefillin and say, oh my gosh, that's what they look like? I never imagined. All the Torah says is bind a sign between your arms and frontless between your eyes. I thought it was a tattoo of a Jewish mother on your bicep, right? I didn't realize it was black square leather boxes with parchments inside that are wrapped around your left arm, put on the head, right? He didn't realize that. The answer is, of course he knew that, right? He knows that from the time he's a little child. In addition, it's a logical system that can be reconstructed using its rules. You see, if I give you a series of numbers, and you see that those numbers follow some type of algorithm, a geometric progression, arithmetic progression, Fibonacci sequence, some form of algorithm, even if you forget one or two of the numbers in the sequence, can you figure out the numbers that are missing?
Yes.
Of course you can. If I give you a random series of numbers, you cannot figure it out. You'll just have to go through many, many tries before you finally get the right answer. But you see, the Torah Shabbal Peh, the oral law, is actually a logical system. There are rules of logic, there are rules of grammar, there are rules of derivation from the text. And consequently, if things don't fit in, you can figure it out. The message also is very central in the lives of people who follow it. A message which is trivial, you forget quickly. A message, if we were all hedge fund or stock traders, and someone gave me a hot tip, right, about some company called ICI, and I stood to gain a few hundred thousand or a few million dollars from the correct information, I probably wouldn't forget. When I phoned the stockbroker, I wouldn't say, was it IBM or ICI? Was it buy or sell? Was it short or long? You wouldn't forget things like that, because it's important to you. What you might forget is something which is not important to you. The oral law throughout history has been very central. Jewish practice has been very central to our lives, much harder to forget. Then there was also review. I once had someone told me the following. I said, how do you imagine the Torah, the oral law, was transmitted? So he painted the following picture. He says, well, there's this elderly rabbi, he's lying on his deathbed, and he calls over his top student, he knows he's going to die, calls over his top student, he says, Yosel, come here. Yosel comes over and the rabbi says, I'm going. He says, where are you going? He says, I'm dying, idiot. He says, oh, sorry. Right? And he says, I've got to tell you the oral law. He says, the oral law? He says, yeah, the oral law. He says, oh, let me get a pen and paper. He says, hello, oral. He says, oh, I'm sorry. Right. Anyway, so I don't know how this guy got to be a top student, but okay. The rabbi tells him the entire oral law. The student memorizes it, and then he waits till he's on his deathbed to call over his top student, Shlomo. He can't wait to use the line oral, right? And he does, but you know what happens is that he says, therefore, each person might, that's ridiculous. That's not how it happened. When do you start teaching about the oral law? On your deathbed? It's ridiculous. People start teaching about it as soon as they can teach, as soon as they're able to. We have a review. We have mnemonic devices. And in the ancient times, by the way, people, before Palm Pilots, before Blackberries and Trios, people had to rely on something called memory. Not RAM, but memory, actual memory in the brain, right? It was the type of thing you had to actually remember things. The ancient world had tremendous memory techniques. Stephen Burstyn talks about this in... Daniel Burstyn, in his book The Discoverers, Librarian of Congress, has a fascinating chapter on memory techniques in the ancient world, because it was very difficult to record information. If you're a businessman in ancient Rome, you imagine you're walking around center city with a large block of granite and a stylus. If you meet an associate for lunch, right, he says, so when do you want to meet? Ides of March? Okay. And you start slamming it into the granite, right? And you have to do this all in Roman numerals as well, by the way, right? So you can imagine information was not easily stored and was not easily found. So people had to use their memories. In the ancient world, the same is true of the Jews. We actually had advanced memory techniques. We used their memories a lot. And indeed, we reviewed, had mnemonic devices, etc. In addition, I would point out one more security mechanism. During the time the oral law was not yet written down, before Judah the Prince wrote it down, where did the Jews live? Two places, Israel and Babylon. And indeed, in both those places we had autonomy. We were ruled by the system of Jewish law. In other words, there was law enforcement, there was an inertia of an entire society and an entire state following Jewish law. It's much harder to forget it if that's the law of the land, if that's state law, if that's what the courts practice, if there's law enforcement. You're driving along in ancient Israel and policeman stops your chariot and says, excuse me, is that a milkshake you're drinking? Yeah. He says, do you mind breathing into the metalizer? And I go... He says, okay, 5.5 hours, I'll let you go this time, right? But basically, let you go with a warning, right? That is, you have law enforcement, you know. Suddenly, a SWAT team shows up at your house on Pesach, and they say, come out with the bread in front of you. Kick it, do not pick it up to Kenyan, right? And they're standing there. So obviously, when you have law enforcement, it's a lot harder to forget things than if you have no law enforcement and if you have an entire society. Today, Jews are a small segment of general population, and only a small segment of the Jewish people actually keeps the Torah Sheval Peh or is even aware of it. So really, we're in a situation where there's an inertia of an entire state, country, society, which is more or less at odds with what we believe in and what we practice. And therefore, we are going against the tide in many different areas. But if you are going with the tide, if that's what the whole country, state is doing, it's quite a different story. And now, there are a couple, and that answers really our third question, the security mechanisms whereby the oral law was kept intact. Is there any evidence of the antiquity of the oral law? Is there any evidence that the Jews kept it before the Mishnah, before it was written down? The answer is yes, there's quite a bit of evidence. First of all, we have artifacts that predate the Mishnah. For example, there are tefillin that go back approximately 2,100 years. They're in the Israel Museum, and they are black square leather boxes with parchments in them, the same parchments we have in our tefillin. In addition, there are mikvahs, Jewish ritual baths from ancient Israel that date back to at least 400 years before the Mishnah was written down. These mikvahs conform exactly to Jewish law. In fact, when Yigal Yadin, the great Israeli archaeologist, found Masada, when he uncovered Masada, there were reports in the newspaper of the most ancient mikveh ever found. Some rabbis in Jerusalem said they'd like to come and examine it, see if it was kosher. This is a rabbinic hobby. If you find something, we want to know if it's kosher. Right? If they ever find life on another planet, the first thing will happen is the OU wants to check if it's kosher. There'll be a unit sent up there in biohazard suits to see if it's check for bugs. Anyway, so the idea is these rabbis wanted to check if it was kosher, not just as a hobby, but really out of interest, because here is a mikveh. It's a great test case. The mikveh was built hundreds of years before the laws were written down. And all it says in the Torah about mikveh is one sentence. It says, ach, however, ma'ayan ubor mikveh mayim, a spring, a pit, and a collection of water, yihyeh tahor, shall be pure. From here you're meant to figure out all the laws of mikveh. And of course, the mikveh was found, and Yigal Yadin records this in his book. The rabbis came out of the mikveh, and one of the rabbis commented, when Yigal Yadin asked him, so, how is it? He commented, shufra de shufra shiva pa'amim, which means in Hebrew, which means the best of the best seven times over. This is basically saying that it is a good mikveh, kosher. And so we have tefillin, we have mikvahs, we have mezuzahs from that time. In addition, we know that Jewish communities all over the world have a consistent calendar. We know that, for instance, even communities that rejected the Torah, Shabbal Peh, the oral law, like the Karaites, their shchita, their slaughter of animals, exactly the same as the Torah, Shabbal Peh requires. There are two other indicators, and we'll end with this. One of them is, they're both in your blood, really. Any Kohanim here? Yeah. Kohanim. How do you know you're a Kohen? Your father told you. What is a Kohen, strictly speaking? A Kohen is someone who believes that on his father's side, he is descended from Aharon, brother of Moshe, brother of Moses, 3,200 years ago. All this on the basis of the fact that your father told you, which is very quaint and beautiful, right? But it's a purely oral tradition. And indeed, those who want to look at the articles, very interesting article about this in Nature Magazine, volume 385. Nature Magazine, volume 385. January 97, in which a Jewish scientist took samples of genes from Kohanim, Jewish men who claimed that they were Kohanim, in England, Israel, and the United States. He found a very high percentage, I think it was over 80%, of Kohanim with something called the Kohen modal haplotype, which is a type of a genetic mutation, doesn't hurt you, don't worry, right, and which indicated that these people had common ancestry on the male side, which is pretty, now it's not like you looked at the DNA and it said Aaron was here, right, but it did say a very, very significant verification of a purely oral tradition. The final one, is also in your blood, and it's something called cholent. Everyone know what cholent is? Cholent is a stew that Jews eat on Shabbos lunch. Now, it is composed of two French words, chaud, which means hot, and lent, which means slow. It's hot, slow food. It's interesting that Jewish communities all over the world all have some form of cholent. It's not always called cholent. In some communities, it's called sechina. Some call it orissa. Some call it shalet. Some, they're all different names, and every Jewish community has its own recipe. Calcutta, the Jewish community has a chamin made of rice and curry and chicken. In the Polish Jewish community, it is made of potatoes and beans. In Germany, it was made with dumpling. In Morocco, made with cracked wheat, garlic, and napalm. Right, but basically, every community has its own form of cholent. What's interesting is, Natural History magazine, there's a magazine called Natural History, which is put out by the Natural History Museum of the United States. And they have an article about an exotic food. Every magazine, they have an article about an exotic food. Cholent was once featured as the exotic food of the month. And the author of the article said, what's interesting about cholent is that communities all over the world have something that they eat, a hot stew for Shabbat lunch, and yet everyone has a different recipe. He says, so what makes it all part of this one dish called cholent? So his answer was, and he's accurate here, very accurate, and it's actually in the Razar of Zrachya Halevi, the Baal HaMa'or, third chapter of Shabbat, he says the following, that, you know, the Karaites were Jews who rejected the oral law. They believed that when the Torah says, Lo tevaru eish b'chol moshvatechem b'yom ha-Shabbat, don't light a fire in your house on Shabbat, they understood it to mean, you're not allowed to have a fire burning. They would sit in the dark, eat cold food, and freeze. So it was not incredibly popular in the cold countries anyway. So, however, Jews who believed in the Torah Shabbal Peh developed a dish that would prove that I believe in the Torah Shabbal Peh. How does it prove it? If I have hot food Friday night, does it prove I believe in Torah Shabbal Peh? Because according to the Torah Shabbal Peh, I am allowed to have a fire burning in the house. I can in a Karaite family, by the way, before Shabbat came in, the husband would say to his wife, honey, did you blow out the candles yet? Because you cannot have candles burning on Shabbat. They'd blow out the candles before Shabbat. And they'd have cold food. So if I have hot food Friday night, it doesn't prove I'm not a Karaite. Because maybe it was hot from before Shabbat. So we developed a dish that you can put on the fire Friday afternoon, and it can be eaten hot Shabbat lunchtime. When I eat it, it proves that I believe in the oral tradition. In fact, well before marijuana, cholent was the ultimate protest food. It was the food that Jews ate in order to say, to protest the rejection of the oral law by the Karaites. It was a way of saying, I believe in Torah Shabbal Peh. And as I said before, when we study it, we inscribe it on our brain. When we eat the cholent, in a sense, we're inscribing it on our arteries as well. So that the oral law is really part of us. Rav Soloveitchik puts it this way. He says, when the Torah is all written down, the Jewish people have the sanctity of the Ark. The Aron Kodesh, the ark that holds the Torah scroll, which is holy, But he says it's not holy as a scroll itself. When the Torah is Baal Peh, oral, when it's not written down, he says the Jewish people are like the cloth, the parchment upon which the Torah is written, which is a much higher level of holiness than the Ark. So when Jews thousands of years ago were in struggle with the Karaites and would say to each other, like, dude, I've got some chilled cholent here, whatever it was they would say, right? And they'd eat the cholent. It was a way of really saying that we believe in the Torah Shebaal Peh. So that's a little bit of an intro to the oral law and the sugya, the section of the rabbi maybe do it. The rest is commentary. Go and learn. Thank you for coming and have a great Hanukkah.